Welcome to the Scientist Podcast, the show for anyone wanting to understand the realities of research life. We bring you into the lives of top academics so that you can get to know the people behind the research that's shaping our world. I'm Jamie, your host, and in this podcast, I'll be bringing you candid conversations each week with those on the cutting edge of their fields. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Scientist Podcast. Today, I'm lucky enough to be talking to Dr. Carolina Rezaval. Carolina is a fellow and biologist at Birmingham University, and her work focuses on the brains of Drosophilas, or fruit flies. Her work aims to reveal fundamental neurological principles that might be present across species. Carolina, hey, how's it going?
Hello, Jamie, how are you?
I'm good. Good to see you. How is the world of Birmingham?
Yeah, everything is good. Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
No, of course not. It's good to see you. I mean, today we're going to talk about your work with Drosophilas, and we'll cover the key scientific benefits, the problem you're solving, and the potential for that research to be used for human benefit. But before any of that, I want to find out a little bit more about you. And I noticed that you're not actually from Birmingham.
No, not at all, actually. I'm from Argentina, from Patagonia, from the south of Argentina.
How does biology happen in Patagonia? How did you get into it?
I think I was a very curious child who would ask a lot of questions about nature all the time. And I was very fascinated about nature, really. I don't know how it happened, but at the age of 7, I already knew that I wanted to become a biologist. And I even wrote this down in a notebook I still have at home. I was really determined to become a scientist and to study biology.
That's a proper piece of memorabilia.
Yeah, it's fantastic, really. And I think that this, you know, love for nature grew over the years. And when I was in high school, I had this fantastic teacher that she would approach biology very differently. She was really passionate about what she was teaching, and she would make us think about questions about the discovery process. And this, like, got my attention, and I just, you know, fell in love even more with biology.
I know, it makes such a difference, doesn't it, when you have a teacher? Especially with biology, because biology can be kind of playful. It's like discovering stuff and finding out about the world and asking questions. But it can also be fucking dry if it's not taught right.
Yeah, it's true. But when you get someone who's passionate about what they're doing and they transmit this passion to you and they basically engage you in the discovery process, in the learning process, that's it really. There's no turning back, and you can fall in love and you can do anything you want in life if you have the right triggers and the right people inspiring you.
So what happened then? So you fall in love with it when you're 7?
Yes, and then later on in high school I decided that this is what I really wanted to do, and then I left my home, Patagonia, and I went to Buenos Aires, the capital of Argentina, to study biology. So then I studied biology, and in Argentina it's fantastic because education is free and everybody can study there. You don't have to pay for it, and the quality of the education is absolutely awesome, and you got this fantastic training during the university course where basically they train you to become a scientist, to ask questions, to be rigorous, to be persistent, and to take information and make it your own and ask your own questions and be super critical. Then I decided that I wanted to do a PhD. I went to an institute there called Leloir Institute, that is one of the top institutes for research. And I did a PhD in circadian rhythms there, so where I wanted to understand how genes control the circadian clock, this clock that we all have, that is present from plants to all the way to humans, and allow us to track the passage of time and know the time of the day.
Cool. So you do the PhD in Argentina, and then you're like, Oxford would be pretty cool. So let's do Oxford.
Yes, I wanted to come to Europe, to be honest. You know, when you decide to do a postdoc, is when you decide that you're going to specialize on a topic and that you're going to be studying that for a very long time. I wanted to go to a very good lab. I had several interviews in the US and also in Europe, and in the end, I decided to come here to Oxford, and I joined the lab of Professor Stephen Goodwin. Yeah, it was very exciting, really.
So obviously, at the minute, you're doing research on Drosophilas. Now, Drosophilas are commonly known as what? Fruit flies?
Yes.
Yeah, which is quite a groovy thing to study. How did you end up studying fruit flies, of all the possible things to study?
Well, I mean, it is crazy if you think about it, because you often find them near the fruits in your kitchen, right? And it's very difficult to understand that actually thousands and thousands of scientists around the world use them to study genetics and behavior. And actually, these little fruit flies have been in the process of discovery for more than 100 years. And many aspects of modern medicine and biology are based on foundations laid through flight research.
And that's because there's basically areas of crossover. So effectively, through studying the fruit flies, we can draw conclusions about mechanics that are relevant to humans.
Well, believe it or not, we share many of our genes with Drosophila. So 75% of genes that have been associated with human diseases are actually present in fruit flies. So many of our genes we share with fruit flies. And we have learned many, many important aspects of how biology works thanks to fruit flies. Over a century ago, there was this guy called Thomas Morgan in his lab at Columbia University. Basically, he identified the first gene in Drosophila. And this started an era of genetics where basically scientists tackle important questions such as how are genes organized and how do they work. And thanks to that, we learned, for example, how genes are organized on chromosomes and the rules of inheritance. But not only that, thanks to fruit flies, we've been able to understand or identify genes that regulate embryonic development, nervous system function. So, for example, how neurons process information. We have discovered many genes in Drosophila, many of which are similar in mammals, including humans. So, for example, the first genes associated with learning were discovered in flies, and they have a similar function in humans. And as well, flies has given us the first genes that control the circadian clock that I was mentioning before, that organizes our daily schedules and causes jet lag. So it's pretty awesome, right? When you think about it, that these little flies, we can learn from these flies about so many biological processes.
I guess they're an interesting combination. There's a lot of overlap between their genes and ours. But also, there's this very obvious point that they're much simpler than us. And there aren't the ethical problems with opening one up and opening the brain of one up. Because, I mean, the problem with humans to study is we're quite complex and we feel things quite sincerely.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you have a point there, because, of course, we don't have these ethical problems with fruit flies, but we can still understand how the brain works by looking at fruit flies, because these tiny fruit flies show complex behaviors such as learning and memory. So they're able to remember things and they can sleep and they show complex courtship rituals, for example. And all these behaviors are controlled by a relatively simple brain of around 200,000 neurons that we can control very well. So if you compare this numerically reduced brain to the mammalian brain that contains millions of neurons, the human brain contains billions of neurons. So you can imagine that it's so much easier to study and to understand. Also, of course, what you were mentioning, the technology that we have at the moment to understand the fruit fly brain is absolutely amazing. So what we can do now, for example, is to open the head of the fly, have a window and access the brain, and we can express proteins that allow us to see when the neurons are firing, basically, are turning on while the fly is performing a behavior. So we can know which neurons get activated while the fly is, for example, courting another animal.
In real time.
In real time, exactly. So we get to see how the brain is behaving as the fly is performing a behavior.
What are you actually seeing when it's open? Are you seeing neurons fire? Are you seeing...
Exactly. Absolutely, we can. We use these fluorescent markers that... Basically, it's like the neurons get green when they become active, when they're firing. So this allows us to see how the fly is making decisions at the same time as this is happening.
I'm surprised it doesn't kill the fly, right? Like if you opened my brain and put color on my neurons so you could see what I was doing in real time, I imagine that would just be me dead. How is it that we get to keep the flies alive and they can still operate?
We use some saline buffer and solution that preserves the tissue. when you want to do this for longer, for many hours, there are also other techniques that you can seal somehow this gap in the head of the fly with the transparent glue, let's say, that it still allows you to look at the activity of the neurons as they're performing.
So in the lab itself, what you end up doing is you have a fly and you want to learn about courtship, say, or the neurons that fire during courtship behaviors. And you get another fly in the room and sort of go on then, like, off you go, like, let's get courting. And then you actually physically see the color light up as that goes. And you go, oh, that's interesting. Those are the patterns in the brain that light up during courtship. Well, given the similarities between fruit flies and humans, well, now we might be learning something about the human brain. Is that sort of the shape of the research?
Yeah, sort of. Basically, in my lab in particular, we are interested in understanding how the brain makes decisions, in particular when an animal is exposed to a conflicting situation and it must prioritize one goal over others, right? So what do you do when you have different needs and you have to prioritize one action? So what do you do, right? So how does the brain resolve conflicting situations? So what we do is, for example, we create conflicting situations for the fly. So for example, we deprive them of food, so they become very hungry, and we don't allow them to mate. So they're sexually aroused and they have the urge to reproduce. So what happens when the animal has both the urge to reproduce, to mate, and to eat? So which behavior wins? What does the animal do? So for example, this is one of the behavioral assays we have in the lab. So then what we do is when we have this very hungry and sexually deprived fly, we give the fly the option of either courting a female fly, or eating from a food source. And then we get to see what the animal does. Does the animal go to the food, or does it prioritize actually mating?
And what do flies tend to do?
What do you think?
I think unbelievably they go for mating. I think what happens is they might be hungry, but like evolution kicks in and now we're mating.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting what you're saying, because this is a difficult decision, right? Or either you preserve yourself, you go and secure food, you know, you eat, or either you make sure that you pass on your genes to the next generation and therefore you mate, right? So there's a conflict there between these two important urgent behaviors, right? But you know that the flies, actually, when we starve them for 24 hours, very hungry, they will actually go for the food. They will prioritize eating over mating.
That says something interesting about the relationship between self-preservation and evolution. Because in my mind, fruit flies, despite sharing 75% of our genes, are fairly basic. I mean, there's definitely more basic creatures, but they're fairly basic. And in my mind, the more basic you go, the more bound to evolutionary process you are. So I'm interested that they pick the food.
Yeah, but this is not a fixed decision. It's not like the fly will always go for the food. So we call it a plastic decision. Basically, it's flexible. And it really depends on the internal needs of the animal. So how hungry the animal is, or whether it has recently mated, or whether the quality of the food is good or not, for example. So it's not like the fly will always make the same decision. So the fly is somehow evaluating the conditions, the factors in the environment, as well as its internal physiological state, to prioritize the most urgent behavior for each situation. So that's really fascinating, and it allows us to study how in the brain all this information from the outside world and from the inside of the animal is assessed and evaluated so the fly can really choose the most urgent behavior.
Exactly, and then presumably what happens is how the fly goes about that decision reveals the nature of the mechanics in humans to some degree. The idea is when we've got difficult decisions to make, which we do all the time, is the idea that that kind of research will hopefully unveil something about how we go about that process on the level of the brain.
Yeah, so of course we have more complex brains with more neurons, with more connections, and we have conscious, which flies don't have. But we can still learn about how the brain works in flies. We can understand rules of how neurons talk one with each other, how they form networks, how they all come together to make a decision. Even if we don't have the same neurons. We humans don't have the same neurons as flies. The same principles might operate in our brains. So we can't, by studying fruit flies, understand how the brain makes decisions, some basic principles that then will help us better understand how more complex brains work, like ours.
What kind of principles come out? What's an example of a neurological principle that goes, well, when you've got to make this type of decision, you end up having this kind of mechanic?
I can tell you about our research, for example. So what we found is that the neurons that tell the fly to go and eat or to go and mate are essentially competing with each other. So if the need to eat is more urgent, then the feeding neurons will take over. They win. Okay, but if the threat of starvation is less, then the urge to reproduce will win. So we got two groups of neurons, the feeding neurons and the courtship neurons, the mating neurons, that are competing one with each other. And whoever takes over will depend on the internal needs of the animal and external conditions of the animal. So basically, maybe in a human brain, we don't have the same neurons, but the same principle, like you have two group of neurons competing that will tell the individual to do something different, either do A or B, are basically competing with each other.
You know the phrase, obviously, neurons that fire together, wire together, and you can have deeper neural pathways, i.e. behaviours that are more regularly accessible. Does that end up helping to shift the debate in your mind? And the deeper the neural systems, the more likely that behavior is likely to win the debate.
So I guess maybe what you're asking is there are some behaviors that are innate, are instinct behaviors, right? One might expect that those behavior will take over. The advantage of using fruit flies is that there are many innate behaviors that we can study, and depending on the conditions that the fly is experiencing, we can know which behavior will win. I'm not sure about what's going on in humans, but what I can tell you is that by studying the smaller brain, as flies have, we can start or begin to understand these very complex questions that are very difficult to tackle in mammalian brains, that we can't even identify the neurons. There are so many neurons, millions of neurons. We can't even know which neurons are involved in these decisions. So then you can imagine that it's even more difficult to understand than how they operate together to control these behavioral processes. So it's really fascinating because thanks to very sophisticated tools available in the fruit fly, we can mutate specific genes as well as visualize and manipulate the activity of even individual neurons with great resolution. And then with these tools, we can study how the fly brain responds when there are conflicting options available and how it chooses amongst them. So the knowledge we gain in the lab may reveal fundamental mechanisms underlying decision-making that might be common to many species, but are very difficult to study in mammalian experimental systems because they have billions or millions of neurons. And the choice between food and sex is a pretty fundamental one. We have to eat to live, but we have to reproduce to pass on our genes to the next generation. So these behaviors, feeding and mating, cannot be displayed simultaneously. So this forces the animal, the fly, to make a decision about what to prioritize. That really allows us to study which neurons and genes are involved in making this decision in flies.
Right, so the neural mechanisms that control reproductive behaviors are sort of in opposition in that moment to the neural mechanisms that control feeding behaviors. In human beings, is the suggestion that because of the complexity, we can make those decisions together or those neural networks aren't necessarily in opposition?
Well, that's a very good question and that we haven't figured out yet in flies either. There are different neural configurations or motif that could mediate behavioral conflicts and decisions in flies and in other species. And one is actually the one, basically what you just explained. So the same neurons could, for example, fire differently, could behave differently when the animal is going for one option or not the other, or maybe different subset of neurons could be competing with each other. There are examples for both mechanisms in nature, and this is what we're trying to figure out in the lab.
Is there a distinction between different types of fruit flies? So fruit flies of different ages or fruit flies of different species?
So there are different species, Drosophila species, that people use to answer questions about evolution or how animals select a partner, how they recognize flies from other species, which is also a very strong research area in Drosophila. We use age and other factors to understand what I was mentioning before. So, for example, how decisions are plastic. What happens if the animal now is older, if the conditions in the environment are different, if the food is not good, if the animal is in a different social context. So, for example, there's competition. So by manipulating these experimental conditions, we get to ask all these questions and understand the underlying neural mechanisms that allow the animal to prioritize an action.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned competition, because competition is sort of the elephant in the room here, in as far as a fly that's presented with two choices and no competition might have a different reaction as one in competition, because if there's now a scarcity game, there's probably good evolutionary reason to imagine that would strengthen one set of neurons as opposed to another.
That's absolutely right. That's a very interesting point. And we do know that flies behave differently when they're surrounded by other flies, and they will make different decisions. So, for example, if there was a competitor there, maybe a fly that will decide to prioritize eating over mating will now secure the female and mate, because there is this competition there, so he has to get the female first.
What does that say about the way that our brains have evolved and the brains of flies have evolved in the context of competition?
Well, that's a very difficult question, but I think somehow the brain must be evaluating what are the available options, and it's not the same if you can go and court the female whenever you want, when actually someone else could get the female, so that option, it's really not available. You have to go and secure the female before the other guy does. What it makes each option more or less attractive is changing depending on the social context, and this impacts in the decision-making of the fly.
Yeah, I ask because I know there's been a number of experiments in humans and babies that show, you know, the toy that wasn't so exciting becomes exciting as soon as you stick another toddler in the room.
Yeah, so there's more motivation, right, to go and get that if other animals are after the same goal. So it becomes more important all of the time, more urgent. I can't make any conclusions about how the human brain works because there's a long way to get there. But what I can tell you is that it's very important to understand how different brains works throughout the animal kingdom, because this all gives us information about processes and how different animals resolve different behavioral conflicts, that eventually all this knowledge will inspire working in humans and whenever we have more tools as well to understand the human brain.
Yeah, and it's just so important to understand initially what the principles are, because otherwise you're trying to attack the human brain, which is a more complicated problem and a more complicated beast, with no background understanding of what mechanics you might expect to appear are.
Yes, absolutely.
And then you're just looking at infinite numbers of firing neurons with some unknown number of relationships that we don't quite understand. And you can't even approach that problem unless you have some grounding that says, okay, well, look, in instances of competing decisions around feeding or sexual behavior, this is kind of how the brain works. And these are the groups of neurons that tend to fire. And from there, you can build. I think in some ways, it's very reflective of the scientific process as a whole, you know, which is just absolutely about reducing the number of variables to understand something really well, and then use that to build on that knowledge to discover and conquer more and more complex issues. And I think that's why it's so interesting to me that flies are so regularly used, and that it's such a happy coincidence that they are in so many ways comparable in as far as 3/4 of genes and lots of diseases, etc., are shared, but also you can check out their neurons and see what's firing and when. It sort of feels like a happy coincidence.
I don't know whether it's a coincidence, it's evolution, right? There are certain aspects of brain function that might have evolved similarly in different species. So there are behaviors that are so important that somehow we need to have neural mechanisms, whether you are a fly or a human, that will allow you to display that behavior, especially with innate behaviors, right? Those that we know we don't need any training or any learning to display, right? So that we know how to do since we are born. So these innate behaviors are genetically determined and hardwired in our nervous systems. So this is very interesting, and studying fruit flies can teach you a lot about those behaviors, right?
What are the big misconceptions that people have around fruit flies and the scientific use of fruit flies?
Well, sometimes people dismiss the use of fruit flies for research because I guess it's very difficult to people actually to picture that a fly can show behaviors, like can learn things, remember things. Flies can sleep as well. And they show these amazing courtship rituals where basically they're able to assess a potential mate and to choose the best partner to copulate. So all these are complex behaviors that it's quite interesting, and people just don't know, right, that the flies that they find in their kitchens are doing all these things and that they have a brain. Actually, a lot of people don't know that fruit flies have a brain. And not only they have a brain, they have a brain that controls very interesting and complex behaviors. And the units of the brain, which are the neurons, are working in many aspects very similarly to the way our brains work. This is the interesting bit, right? We can use that brain to understand very complex neural processes.
Yeah, I mean, there's this very superficial level on which, because flies are really, really small, you kind of just can't quite imagine them having the level of complexity. Because on one level, big equals complex and small equals uncomplex. So what do you mean there are sets of neurons that have shared mechanics with human brains? It sort of just seems like a leap. It's a leap that if you don't take, you're unable to then look at the human brain with very much context. And the scientific context is kind of the whole thing when you're looking at the human brain. Because otherwise it is just so complicated. And unless you go in with some base level of understanding, it's just very hard to imagine studying it in any way that's fruitful.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just need to look back and see what we have learned from flies, because it's really there. Researchers for their studies in fruit flies have earned 6 Nobel Prizes, for example. A lot of the knowledge that we currently have about different biological processes, developmental processes, behavioral processes, come from knowledge that we obtain using fruit flies. It is there. It's fantastic.
It's super exciting. And how do you see it progressing in the next 10, 20, 30 years?
So something that is very fascinating about the fruit fly at the moment is that the connectome has been figured out. So this is, the connectome is a map of the brain where all the connections between all the neurons in the brain have been basically dissected. And we know how now at the level of synaptic level, how the neurons are contacting one with each other. So we have a map of the brain with all the neurons and how they're connected one with each other. So this is absolutely fantastic, because now we can, in addition to using assays for understanding how flies display behaviors or make decisions, now we can connect those behaviors with the neurons, and then we can try to understand how these neurons work together, because we know now how they're connected one with each other to make those decisions. So I think that that's going to be the next challenge, really. It's like we have an alphabet, a new alphabet, and now we have to understand how it works. And so we'll have to make those connections, really.
Yeah, I mean, once you have the map of all the possible connections, then the game changes a little bit. Because now you can effectively map behaviors onto something you already have a written down understanding of, which just then makes the process of observing behavior and interpreting behavior that much easier, right?
Yes, absolutely. And with flies, we can target individual neurons or even a small number of neurons. Then we can, you know, little by little, piece this map together. We can basically crack the brain. We can identify those elements that form part of the neural network and see how, you know, they're working all together to make decisions. So it's really fascinating what we can do at the moment in Drosophila neuroscience.
It's totally fascinating and it's totally surprising, and I feel like I've learned an immense amount.
It's been great. I mean, I had a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
No, thank you for coming on. I think this is an area of research that people basically don't know about. 6 Nobel Prizes is, I mean, that's a crazy statistic. You know, there's lots of things that, upon first hearing about them, raise eyebrows, and within 30 seconds you go, oh yeah, how did I not think of that before? That seems an entirely natural step to take. which I guess is reflected by 6 Nobel Prizes and increasingly exciting research. So Carolina, thank you so much for coming on. It was great to chat.
It was fantastic to chat with you, and you asked very interesting questions and I had a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. Wilson, thank you for listening to the Scientist podcast. And as always, we'll be back next week.